Come on and join me on the B-side. When movie stars that weren't in their prime made other movies that got left behind, that got them covered on the B-side. You're gonna like it on the B-side, 'cause you got Dan and Connor by your side, throwing your knowledge from the inside. And now you're listening to the B-side.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the B-side. Here we talk about movie stars and filmmakers, and not the movies that made them famous or kept them famous, but the ones that they made in between. And today we have a really fun conversation for you with sort of legendary indie filmmaker Larry Fessenden. He's been dubbed the Roger Corman of the East Coast, just given the way that he manages his very lean, scrappy productions. And he has a new movie out on all digital platforms April 12th called Blackout. It's a werewolf picture that is kind of a new addition to Larry's ongoing little monsterverse, following up Habit from the 90s and Depraved from just a few years ago. It's a great little movie, and we got the chance to sit down with Larry and talk to him not only about Blackout, but also the way he kind of wears a lot of hats. He's done everything from producing to directing to writing to acting to editing. He got his start with filmmakers like Kelly Reichardt in the movie River of Grass, which we talk about a little bit. And he also shares some great anecdotes about working alongside Martin Scorsese on Bringing Out the Dead, and most recently Killers of the Flower Moon, as well as his crossing paths with the likes of Guillermo del Toro. So enjoy this conversation. Dan and I had a great time talking to him. He, again, has just some great insights into the world of small, kind of low-budge, no-budge filmmaking. And he really just kind of talks about it all with a fervor that sort of, I think, highlights why he's one of the most fascinating people doing it at that level. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Larry Fessenden.
Hello, everybody. This is a very special episode. We're here with Larry Fessenden, who, you know, I don't even know how to really, how would you introduce yourself, Larry, I guess, because there's
multi-hyphenate. So I mean, more than what's the first?
all of the hyphenates. Yeah. How would you introduce yourself?
I'm a filmmaker, but I'm with books and video games, or I have. But, you know, I'm a sort of a marginal creative person.
I think I was reading a, because I was doing some research, and I feel like it was a Fangoria interview or some sort of coverage, and they described you as East Coast Roger Corman. How does that feel? Does that feel right-ish?
It's right, because it's been repeated, just like Donald Trump. Well, if you repeat it enough, people believe it.
Print the legend.
No, listen, I'm honored by that. The reference is obviously that I make low budget movies and churn out a lot of films. I think where I differ is, you know, I take the art seriously, and I'm maybe not as successful as he was at sort of cashing in, but Corman is a great model. And the other thing I do really admire about him is he sort of reached back and took some of the guys when they were getting old, like Karloff and Peter Rory, and mm-hmm. he sort of had that in mind. For him, they were names that maybe audiences had forgotten. I worked with Angus Scrimm back in the day, and he did a lot of our films. He wasn't forgotten, but the point is that he was an example of us sort of finding new comrades from the older work. So yeah, sure, I'm the Roger Corman of the East Coast. That work.
Well, it stood out to me because he keeps coming up on so many of our podcasts. Like we had Carl Franklin on last year, and he worked with Corman. We had John Sayles on a month ago, and obviously he came up with Corman. We did a Halloween episode where we were focusing on some of Corman's early stuff, which is really good. Like a lot of it's really, I mean, as you say, he definitely knew how to cash in, but so much of it's really, you know, interesting and progressive, and so it's just,
you know, for his motto, he wanted water films, but for the filmmakers, it was a way to get started. So, yeah, I really admire his place in history. It's very
beautiful
being included in.
Now, before we look back at all the stuff you've been a part of, which is so much, we wanted to bring up Blackout, which, as we're recording, in the middle of March here, I think, you know, it's new film from you, written and directed,
produced, edited,
right. as we're recording, and you can tell me more about this. There's a New York engagement at the IFC Center, right? And there's an art of the MonsterVerse. Can you tell us a little bit about this? This podcast will come out after, obviously, you know, the day we're recording, but just for context, because it is interesting.
Well, the movie Blackout is about a painter who may or may not be a werewolf at night. And so there's a lot of sort of references to art, and a lot of paintings are in the film. And then there's even some animations when he's describing his experience. It sort of goes into this weird psychedelia. Because I'm an old-timey filmmaker, I had 300 paintings created by the artist James Seward, and those are the animated moments from it. So, in other words, it's a very tactile little film, and not something that you can do at a budget if you just use time on your side. So, the art of that MonsterVerse is sort of a recap of the three films that I've done. They reference the Universal Monsters. I made a film called Depraved, which is a Frankenstein story, contemporary. I made a movie called Abbott back in the old days, which is a vampire story, and here's a werewolf. So, you know, in order to sort of, I might talk about Roger Corman, you know, I'm like a salesman, say, oh, so it's a monster person. So I have put some of the art, beautiful posters by Graham Humphreys, the sort of retro style. He's a wonderful UK painter, and I asked him to do all three posters of these three movies, and then I have the animation cells just to celebrate really the tactile nature. I mean, 300 individual paintings. I think it's actually 250, he told me. It's beautiful, and I just love celebrating all the artistry that goes into a film. You know, it's not about budget. It's about seducing these people to do things and be part of building the vibe of the movie.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, Blackout is, yeah, it's such a, obviously, a worthy companion. You mentioned Habit, you mentioned Depraved. We should say, funny enough, a friend of ours who's been on this podcast, Chad Harbold, he produced Depraved. You know, I know you know Chad. And I asked Chad before this, I was like, anything you want, we should definitely ask Larry about. He gave me a couple of things that we can get to later if we have time. I wanted to mention, actually, just in terms of origins, because Jordan Raup and myself, we started the film stage in college a while ago, a long, long time ago. And I was just chatting with him literally right before we started recording. And me and him were remembering, and I bet we didn't even know who you were at this point, right? Because we would have been 19 or something. But I remember vividly watching, and it would have been just when it came out too. So maybe we got it from like the family video or something.
Yeah.
We watched The Last Winter, and it was like Jordan heard about it and was like, oh, I hear this movie's good. Like, we had watched The Thing, and I don't, you know what I mean? It was like that. And then we, in that same year, and you didn't direct this, but you're in it, we watched and fell in love with Session 9.
Yeah.
And which Brad Anderson, and that movie, I think, was shot kind of where me and Connor are from, right? That's like Hudson Valley-ish, right?
Yep.
Session 9?
That in Massachusetts. That was haunted. And of course, you know, there's certain movies where the crew starts going slightly crazy, and they were there were ghosts. And it was really spooky. It was a defunct. I mean, I don't know. There's not a nice way to say it. You know, it's a loony bin, and it was really frightening. And of course, I don't know. It's almost like it was like a movie set. All the papers and it tripped over wheelchairs. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It was really, so everybody felt it was truly scary. And Yeah.
Yeah.
And then in that movie, I think it was one of the very first digital films. I get my eye stuck out with an ice pick. And I remember they just had the handle and they were doing that. And we were all like, how did this go? This is so silly. Like, oh, we're going to CGI the ice pick. Like, okay, good luck with that. Well, of course, amazing. And that really is a beloved film. There are a lot of
it is.
Cool movies. I mean, it's actually scary.
Well, you know what's funny though? I just thought of this because I was rewatching Habit last night. You know, because as you mentioned, you know, Habit, Depraved, and Blackout, they're kind of a piece, obviously. And it's funny because Brad Anderson made that movie Happy Accidents,
which
a few years out. Are you in that?
I mean, I think I'm a flashback to a bad boyfriend, so I am in it. In that crowd.
Okay, so but what I kept thinking of was that was a couple years after Habit, right? But
yeah,
those movies capture New York in that time so beautifully, where like it wasn't that long ago, but now it's, you know, almost 30 years ago. And even watching Habit last night, I just was like, oh man, that must have been awesome. Like, it just feels like a different city. I mean, it was a different city. And I hadn't thought of Happy Accidents, but since we brought up Session 9, Brad Anderson, like, it's, there's such a tactile nature to both of those films, Habit and, I mean, they're so different, obviously, but you know what I mean? It's like,
well, it's City West. You could steal shots. It was a little more welcoming. I mean, that's sort of true of the whole world. Nothing, everything wasn't so officious. In a weird way, Abbott feels like it calls back to Taxi Driver more than it calls forward to now. You know, it's just, there was a grit to the city, not to romanticize crime or anything, but, you know, it's just had a different vibe. And, but, you know, what they all have in common is that the color palette, something about New York, the red and the green and the yellow of the lights at night, and plus the neon and and obviously daytime shoots, all of that. I recently watching Woody Allen movies, even Woody Allen captures this feeling of New York. I realized I am responding to that sort of nostalgia, which is also nostalgia kind of filmmaking, long, long takes, beautiful. This and that. So, yeah, it's both.
And then what? So bring it back to Blackout, just to kind of finish the loop here. So, like, it's so interesting, right? And I wonder about this. It's a werewolf story, right? We don't want to spoil too much. And we should mention, actually, April 12th is when it'll be available on all digital platforms. So, if you're listening now, it's coming right up, right? So definitely mark that for kind of wherever you watch movies, you know, Apple, whatever, that's where it'll be. And I was so curious because, you know, you've been an indie pioneer forever, right? So it must be harder now to get the funding, but easier to film it. Like, I guess, what is the, does it even out? I mean, I'm sure it doesn't. I'm sure everything's harder now, but I'm just curious because watching Blackout, like, it obviously looks so much different than, you know, even Depraved or obviously Habit, like you mentioned, but there's so much. I feel like you're doing so much in Blackout and it feels, you know what I mean? Like, it feels like you're getting a lot out of it that maybe you couldn't have done with Habit, but then at the same time, there's stuff in Habit that you probably couldn't do now. I mean, how keenly aware of you over those differences as you're like making Blackout now as opposed to, you know, 30 years ago, I guess?
Well, one of the main things is you're shooting digitally. I often, when I approach a movie, it's not a given that you'll be digital. There's still the flirtation with film. As a producer, I've made movies in celluloid until very recently. In other words, I offer that as an option to the filmmaker. It does add some cost, but more, it also focuses the mind. So that's something that's lost in the digital world and also the modern world. I mean, you look over your crew member and they're on their phone. It's just a tiny heartbreak. They're still doing their job, but you're like, oh, I like it when we're all watching the actor, we're really engaged. So, you know, our minds are all melting in the modern world. What I try to do is the same thing I've always done. And you can do it at different budget levels, of course. But, you know, when you're safely in the no budget world, you really depend on the collaborators that you're working with, a sense of focus, a sense of immediacy, and also taking advantage of happy accidents, speaking of that, things that, you know, you're not controlling everything. That's actually part of the excitement. It's a little more improvisational, punk rocky. It doesn't mean you haven't planned your shots and you're not thinking about pacing and every other craft-oriented thing, but you're also in the moment. Maybe you didn't actually have ownership over a location, so you kind of have to live with what's happening and just dance around. That's how I made Blackout. We have many locations, and we didn't really own any of them. We just made handshake deals and said, you know, we're going to be light on our feet. Can we come and to invade your space? So what I like is making films in that sort of handcrafted way where you're making deals. It's a personal thing. You're not just throwing money at a problem, which is a wonderful thing to be able to do. You know, you have a good location manager and they buy out the space and everybody walks away happy. This is a little different. It's a little more nuanced. It's a handshake deal. It's your honor is on the line. And I like that level of engagement, and it makes everyone need to be on their toes. I don't know if I'm answering your question. In a way, I make movies the same way as I did with Habit. As far as the world, yes, technically you have. I mean, my favorite thing about the modern thing is the lights. They're so cool. They're so little, you can just, you know, that we need. That's, I think, the real technology that's changed. You still might put an HMI outside a door, but the fact is that now they're LEDs and you can change the color temperature, all this fun. It's one of my favorite improvements. You know, they're not as hot, so it's better for actors. They're, you know, what I like to do is to make the technology as invisible as possible so that you're sort of, experiencing the story. And then what's fun is if you're making a fantasy film, you're asking people to kind of believe the unbelievable. And that's what the agenda of the movies are for the audience, but it's kind of fun to do that in the making of, so that you're all in this world. And I mean, that's just my approach, this kind of immersion. So that part of it is more available.
Yeah.
Speaking of the then to now, I mean, you know, as an editor, you've been an editor for a really long time. I mean, the cognitive leap there, I feel like if you're thinking about, you know, River of Grass to Blackout or something like that, you must be more relieved now as an editor to not be like sweating over a Steenbeck or something like that.
Yeah, but of course, I really, I cherish that I had that experience. I made a movie.
Totally.
And we edited on a flatbed. And the only thing I say, it's not like the old days were better. In fact, they were worse. I loved digital editing. But I'm blessed to have started in film editing. So you have to develop theories of the cut. I always say You have a wide shot and the arm moves. And then you go to a close-up. Do you repeat the arm move? Do you absolutely do it at the peak here? Do you do it at the end? These are fun things. And now I won't be able to tell you what my theory is, but I can assure you that at least you've thought about that, because you know, every time you cut it, it's embarrassing when your work cut has like 15 little cuts because you couldn't see it.
Sure.
But I also say there's something beautiful about that. What I like about film is what would be, you know, easily called a Hitchcock approach, where you actually map it out, because you're the only question is, when you have a script, is how are you going to tell the story? And, you know, They didn't even care what the stories were. It was more about how to present it, how to engage the audience, and so on. And I love talking about that with filmmakers. So it's really why I produce, but I want to just get into those conversations, and that gets the films made. You know, we didn't really, I don't know if I answered about budget. I mean, it's a heartbreak, because you don't really know how to get the money at the back end. Streamers, they're not, I don't know if they're dishonest, but they're not sharing what's going on. So it's just a very disarming And I've seen it happen, like with Slow Motion Trainwreck, you know,
obviously
the Devil got a streaming deal and they never reported whether it was a success or not.
It's very opaque.
Yeah, it's just nasty. It's everything that you fight against when you're young and believe in workers' rights and all that. It's like, what's going on? We're all in this together. I don't get it. Why are you being so sneaky? And I think it's hurt the Netflix model. You know, they have to pay top dollar for every actor because they don't share the profits down.
Right.
And so the actors are like, well, I don't know. You've got to give me everything up front because you're so dishonest. Or as I say, it may not be dishonesty, but it's just a bad look to be keeping.
Well, it's like it's like the reason a movie winds up costing $200 million if it's made for streaming, because all of those deals are made with actors up front, like you're talking about. And it looks insane if nobody watches it, right? Like,
it's all above the line before they even start pressing record.
Yeah. Right? It's a different model. And ironically, Jason Gorham uses the liner that I use, which is to say, I guess, well, we both came up with that at the same time. But, you know, he does share the profits. Ethan Hawke will do the purge, really, for scale. But he's got some points. And then when the points kick in, he gets his check. So everybody's happy. Everybody feels seen and respected. And then we have 15 Purge movies. Whether that's a good thing, I don't
know. All right.
you know, this sort of thing. So I prefer that model.
Do you...
Go ahead, Kyle.
I was just going to say, does the multi-hyphenate thing... Is that a creative choice, a budgetary choice, a little bit of both? Where is it something you want to keep your head in and that's why you wear so many hats? Or is it more, it's going to be easier budget-wise if I do four things, right, on this, as opposed to just producing? Or
the real truth is that I consider myself, well, I don't know how I answered that question, but I'm a filmmaker. And if that means that I'm helping someone else figure out how they're going to direct their movie and finding the money. I mean, I'm not very good at finding money, unfortunately, but the point is I like to make connections. But creatively, I edit because that's where I'm headed. I'm only shooting for the edit. You know, I have in mind the movie, and it doesn't usually come out the way I picture it, but actually, shot for shot, that is what I had in mind, because the way I write a script, I always say I'm not a writer, but I create the blueprint for the movie. Then I shoot the movie, and then it's edit. And then always you fix it in sound, is what I like to say. So it's really not, it's not strategic to save money, although I have one quick thought on it. But it's because it's just a very holistic experience, the way I approach it. It doesn't mean that I wouldn't benefit from an editor. And of course, I do enjoy showing. Well, I don't really. I don't even show cuts. My agenda is to make something that I imagine. It doesn't mean I'm smarter or better or anything. It's just I believe in trying to find the truth of what I'm trying to say. And that's what I want to make. And it's very possible that's why financing is tough, because there's a sense that I'm not. I just can't have a conversation about what's going to be more commercial. That just doesn't seem what the purpose of art is. But I will say, what I do try to save money is, you know, on all the fussy things, I'm too cheap to hire people. And I also was my own AD, which is clearly unusual. But it's just because I knew what had to happen. And I had deal with the location. So I said, look, I told the lumberyard we're going to be there in some 2 or 4. So that's what has to happen. So I would just tell everyone what had to happen rather than have someone to tell everyone.
Sure, sure.
I would deeply respect the wearer of the AD, which is why I proudly took it. That's all. but that is absurd. That means I have no right. Amen. I have a full schedule in my. But that's how we made this movie. It was fun. To me, I mean, who would suffer? I don't
know. No, I mean, look, I think that's incredible, first of all, for those who understand movie making, that to be an AD, to be your own AD, you know, because the whole point of an assistant director, right, is to, you know, you're the creative mind, the director, and the point of the assistant director, you know, I've AD'd a bunch in my, you know, we're, me and Connor are both producers by day, and we work, a lot of commercial. As a matter of fact, we did a thing funny enough, we were laughing about this last night, me and Connor. Literally in January, we were in Indianapolis making a commercial, and we had we flew in our DP and gaffer from New York, and our gaffer was Zach Kangas, who gaffed. who gaffed Blackout, which we were laughing about. And we know, funny enough, Zach, not to go down a tangent, Zach, we made a short film that I co-directed, Connor produced 10 years ago, Connor,
yeah,
right?
Probably, yeah, about, yeah.
Called Strange Bird. And I think Zach was like helping with art, right?
Yeah, he was like we'll call him a swing. That was the
it was like 10 of us at like a cabin in Massachusetts. And then we were putting together this commercial, and we shot in Indianapolis. It was like a press day thing. And our DP was like, I got a gaffer. And it was Zach. And we were like, we know this guy. And then, funny enough, watching your movie, we were like, hey, we still know this guy. Good for Zach.
Zach was with us. We would exchange books on philosophy during the shoot of Blackout, which was really fun. I liked, he had a sort of a stoic nature, and I jived on that. And yeah, so that's
funny.
Well, personal art, this level art, I feel, oh, it's, you know, there's a camaraderie, you know, we're all in the lifeboat together at this scale of film, and you know, everyone has to pull their weight. I mean, however, more metaphors I can use, everyone has to, because we're in the lifeboat, everyone wants to bail.
So I guess I wanted to bring up, there's so much, it's like hard to even, I have like a million notes I keep looking at, like, it's like, but I wanted, so like, you're also a great actor, right? Like, it's interesting, right? So and you produced a lot of Kelly Reichardt's movies, obviously. You were in River of Grass. You're great in it. River of Grass, for those who don't know, seek it out. It's Kelly's kind of first proper feature, 94. And it's basically like Badlands with less money, right? It's such a Kelly Reichardt movie because it's like, you're like, okay, it's like her Badlands. And then you're like, oh no, it's like a Kelly Reichardt movie, right? It's like very much like, I love that about it so much.
The tagline was a road movie that never gets off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Badlands without the murders.
Yeah, it's like, what if it was Badlands, but they got like 50 miles and nothing that
happened? Two people who thought they were in Badlands and in fact were never in Badlands.
What? Accurate. Description, because it is also, oddly enough, like my own films, sort of playing with the expectations of genre, and then they're being undermined because life isn't even like it is.
Yeah, and like habit is so much that, which is like, you know, and you know, we call ourselves the B side. That's definitely an A side of yours. So, you know, but Seek It Out, I mean, we keep bringing it up. It's, you know, around the same time as River of Grass, and it's, you're in that too. Obviously you directed it, but you're in the film as well. And I just, it's interesting because another more recent movie, which I think you could call a B side, though it definitely got a lot of attention, was you were, you know, in an ensemble movie from just last year called Brooklyn 45, which Ted Geegan, who we know, similar, like you said, kind of we're all in the same indie boat, blah, blah, you know, what have you. We watched that a couple nights ago in prep for this. That's its own brand of subversion and kind of taking this period drama. You know, I guess here was my question, because when you're acting, right, you're acting in that movie. Is it a relief to just take direction, or you like find yourself itching to like provide more, you know, I don't know, input, or is it fun?
My sort of framing of things is that I'm there to serve the work. And I say, you know, it's not about, well, of course, ego is omnipresent. It's a subversion of the ego to the work. And even in my own film, you know, I'll fight for things for the sake of the movie, not because I have an important vision. And, you know, so it's a way of talking about the work. And when I'm an actor, my agenda is to do the very best I can for the director. And I like being subservient, so to speak. Now, you will find every now and again, I'm a bit opinionated, not because I know the best way to tell a story, but I've been on enough sets that I do have an intuition or just an impatience. I'm like, let's get the work done. I feel like maybe we don't need that or whatever. So I'll every now and again chip in, but it's hopefully only in the service of what I'm understanding the director. So, but I really don't try to manspread. And I have my own personal way of making things. I wouldn't want or expect someone else to would follow that. But having said that, I've been ordering up sets that I would say, I think we can get this, we can do that. And I only try to talk when I'm helpful, as opposed to just, here's Larry with all the opinions.
What drew you to Rick Alverson in those comedies? Because those are definitely kind of really funny. Like you produced, you know, the comedy, other films. What Jordan Raup, who I mentioned before, he loves those films. Like what draws you to that? You know, world, I guess that's so subversive and interesting.
Well, once again, it's Rick's intelligence. He has a very specific perspective as a filmmaker, yet he brings his own sense of pacing, his own process. His scripts are, 16 pages long. So Bailing Pat is really thrilling thing of he's going to get in there with an actor and they're going to build the movie. Why? And that's fantastic. Joe Swanberg is another filmmaker who works that way. I worked with him as an actor serving his vision. And he's in turn.
He's in Blackout. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it was just incredible. I mean, we got it on the second take, wide shot. And I said, God, you flew all the way here. I guess we'll do coverage. I didn't use any of it. Although the nice thing you see is by just forcing myself to do that, I use it in another moment in the film, and I'm so grateful to have that close-up. But the bottom line is just Joe is magically great screen presence and knows how to get in and out, as it were. So, yeah, we added on take two. And the only thing for me was I just adjusted him. He's being too much of a douche. So I said, Joe, ease back a little and then perfect. So, whatever. I just want to say that Alverson, there's part of me, I am, everyone knows, basically a closeted horror guy. So Alverson doesn't make horror movies, but I think the comedy is true horror movies. That's how it's canon. It's just about, whenever it was made, it was incredibly prescient about the breakdown, the over saturation of irony in the privileged white guy's world. It's just an amazing skin crawling movie and deeply insightful and challenging. I think that's wonderful. So I love Rick's films. I was in the math briefly and then I was involved in entertainment. All three wonderful.
We should say, speaking of New York, and you're in one of the great Scorsese B-sides, Bringing Out the Dead.
Yes, thank you. I mean, overlook. I don't get it. It's such a cool movie. It's really
great movie.
It's great. Yeah.
Well, the music, Lenny always knows, this kind of certain type of rock music that just drives the film. The camera work is bananas, and then you have the pleasures of Nicolas Cage and Nicolas Cage, Nicholas Trump, and what the hell?
Vinny Rames.
Vinny Rames and John Goodman. Patricia Arquette, great cast, also the bad guy, great actor. So anyway, and a New York story, it was written by Schrader, and of course, as usual, it's Marty's themes of guilt and religion and all the redemption and so on. Beautiful movie.
It's so interesting. And then obviously this is, it's probably one of the most interesting parts of the movie, but you're in the last scene of, Killers of the Flower Moon.
Little known movie, Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah.
The A-est A side in the world, but it just, how did you get connected with Martin Scorsese, actually, now that I'm thinking about it? You've been in more than those two, right?
I auditioned for Shelter Island, and the word was that I was too crazy. Overacting, I guess, but I love that. So, well, the casting agent is aware of me, and she'll call if she thinks. And she knows, I mean, Whitey has, I think, an awareness of cinema at every level. So he knows I'm a New York filmmaker. And like,
right.
Well, he likes to build communities. Look at Killers. It's amazing musicians doing such good acting.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I can't rattle off every name, but that's, you know, that's clean because he loves musicians and he loves other types of art. He wants to bring it in and create that party. And so this is what I think is so wonderful about Scorsese. I mean, you know, you see it's in Iggy Pop, it's in the Color Moving, Color of Money, and, you know, I think Scorsese loves to build these worlds. And in fact, the casting agent would say to me, Ellen Lewis, she would say, you know, Mighty really likes you for this. He's just sort of creating an ensemble. So that was an incredible privilege, obviously.
I wanted to bring it, because I was just referencing, talking to Chad. You love, not surprisingly, he mentioned this, and this is not, feels obvious, you love the original Universal Monster movies.
Yeah.
Is there one... is there a B-side of those that you love? And follow up, now that you've made Blackout, which is werewolf adjacent, as we said, do you have a hope to make your Creature of the Black Lagoon or anything like
right.
that?
Are you going to make an Invisible Man movie? Or
right. Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, B-side. I mean, there's Frankenstein in there, Wolfman, I guess, in Dracula. Was never as captivated by Dracula, but it is cool to watch again. You realize Lugosi is so,
yeah,
it's so iconic. It is such a cliche almost because he created that part. But I always found that one a little more dull. I think Frankenstein is just one of the great films ever made. It's just very spare. Everyone prattles on about Bride of Frankenstein, but to me that's more ornate. I love the spareness, the punk vibe of Frankenstein. But lesser talked about is, and it's not a Universal picture, but it's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Wow, yeah.
One of the great films ever. It's so shocking, even now, right, with fatality. The performance is amazing and the filming. So I recommend that. And then you just joked about The Invisible Man. That's also a great B-side because it's not quite as celebrated, but it's like a lean, mean, you know, 68 minutes. Also really vicious. And a wonderful performance, obviously off camera by Claude Rains. And that's made by the guy who made Frankenstein. So all good stuff. I do love the Creature. One of my top three guys of those. Everyone's always saying, why are you going to make a mummy movie? I'm like, absolutely not. Not even if they gave me 100. We'll see about that, but affection for the mummy. And I even like the bad ones more than the Karloff one, which feels very snoozy. But anyway, give me the first 6 minutes of that movie, that's okay.
Yeah.
Well, so as you see, very excited by those films. I love them growing up, and they still, then you watch them and you're like, oh, wow, this is so weird. I'm having, you know, I'm sort of re-looking at something that had meaning when I was little. Well, that's what movies are, of course. You can revisit them. It's so interesting. And that different every time of your life. So, but
yeah, I always talk about. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to veer into. Anyway, Chad Resnick, AD on to play. So I'm very fond of Chad and what he brought to that. Just proving that it's a great world and can be done by highly intelligent collaborators. So.
Yeah, Depraved is really good. I mean, like, you know, Blackout, we're talking about Depraved, obviously, connection there. You know, that the Depraved, more of a Frankenstein type of a thing, obviously. I don't want to spoil any of these movies. I love that Addison Timlin is in Depraved and Blackout. I don't want to give away too much, but obviously there's a lot of connective tissue, you know, purposeful in those two movies. I was going to ask you, though, with Habit, is there anything I missed that connects Habit, or no? Is that just its own?
Let's say in a good way, not yet.
Okay.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's cool. Yeah, I don't want to overly, you know, because I, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing, you know, back to Perlman, is that I'm also just a showman, and I'm making these connections after the fact. I'm not setting out, like, with my you know, Universal Monsters and like, oh, I'm going to do this. And then in 7 years, I'm going to do that. No, that's not how it works. It's all very organic. And
right.
But these are the creatures that I live with. I also associated with the Wendigo, which is a Native American mythology. And that I made one film when by chance I sort of made a sequel. The Last Wendigo had Wendigo adjacent themes. And then randomly I did a TV show that they had a script already and it was a Wendigo movie. So of course then I became the Wendigo guy. That's why I was hired to do Until Dawn. It's a video game with Wendigo. Yeah. So
is that Fear Itself, the Drew McQueenie thing, the script?
Those guys had written it, Scott and Drew, is that right? And then, this is funny. I mean, in my world, I pitched them basically Blackout. I pitched them a werewolf story, and they said, you know, we already have scripts. Also, we already have a werewolf story. So they said, but what about this? And I'm like, oh, Wendigo? Well, okay, sign me up. So that was fun. And I got to work with Doug Jones, which I always say was one of the only great ideas I ever had. I just woke up. I was like, how am I going to depict the Wendigo? It's very different from the Antler Man that I had created for my own film. And then I just was like, oh, my God, Doug Jones. And I'll tell him he doesn't have to wear all the makeup, just a little. And the rest will be up to him. And I called Guillermo del Toro and said, will you advocate for me? And I got on the phone with Doug, one of the most joyous people you'll ever encounter. And we hit it off and we had a lot of fun. I got a lot of laughs.
It's funny because Doug basically played the creature in The Shape of Water.
And that's right. Well, Edmund was a couple steps ahead of me, unfortunately, but blessing to have him. He's making it Frankenstein.
I know. It's so crazy. It's like two Frankenstein movies are happening.
I feel a little tragedy in my life is that, you know, Guillermo and I worked on a book called, The Orphanage. It was a remake it didn't quite happen. And when it fell apart, Guillermo said, fascinating, got me something. Real quick, straight up quick. And I was like, oh my God, I have my movie depraved. And he's like, I'm not reading a Frankenstein story from you. Are you out of your mind? And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, I'm making my own. So a smart filmmaker would have then written a perfect script for him, but I was obsessed with making to pray.
Brings it back to the beginning. You're an original. You're an artist. That's the whole point. I mean, you can't help it. That's, you know, it's not like...
You can't help it.
You can't help it. That's a good thing. So as we kind of come to the end, I just wanted to bring it... Well, I wanted to ask you, so Blackout, bring it back to Blackout, but are there any of your own, you know, produced, acted, directed, written, whatever, like B-sides, hidden things, something that didn't get... you know, discovered the way you wanted it to, anything you would tell people? You mentioned Wendigo. That's a great movie. That's Patty Clarkson, Jake Weber. That's not, I wouldn't say that's really a B-side. That's had a lot of traction, but is there anything in your oeuvre that you would recommend to people to seek out?
No. I mean, Beneath was really disparaged. It was right when social media was starting, and I think the kids were having so much fun just being nasty. In other words, I think it's a fun movie and kind of was a political parable, a bunch of kids in a boat. I mean, instead of working together to kill the fish or escape from it, they turn on each other. And this, to me, I said it at the time, I was just depicting the U.S. Congress, little knowing how much worse it was going to get. So
right.
That movie, I think it's a satire. I think the kids are great. But it's funny, you know, people don't like the characters. They start saying acting is bad. So it's not a B-side, but it's a movie that I think deserves a second look. Not that it's great, but I think it's a nice piece. You know, it's clearly wasn't my script, but I had my hand in it, so I take responsibility. All my films are sort of whatever, and that's fine because they're filling a certain niche. I'm interested in psychological realism. The only thing I will say of egotist is that the types of movies that I've been making, it's now that's accepted. who was it when I started? People didn't know what this was. Is this an R movie or where's the burlap? Whereas all we understand that social commentary and personal psychological dramas can play in the horror space and that horror can have, which it was good in my mind. But for the general public, they now accept a more psychological flavor in their scare films.
Right. Well, Larry, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. We covered a lot, not nearly enough, but next time we'll do more.
Thank you.
Oh, really fun, guys. Thank you.
There's our interview with Larry Fessenden. We hope you enjoyed it. He, like I said, is just a fascinating dude because of all sort of the little avenues of both filmmaking, big and small, that he's sort of touched. But we were thrilled to talk with him. Blackout, as I mentioned, is available April 12th on all digital platforms, so you can check that out. Thank you for listening. You can rate, review, subscribe wherever you've heard us. We appreciate it a great deal. You can follow us on social at TFSBside. That is also a great help. Coming up in 2 weeks, we have a great episode with our dear friend Blake Howard, who returns to celebrate his forthcoming One Heat Minute Productions miniseries on sneakers titled Too Many Minutes. He's going to be unpacking with us the B-sides of the great Robert Redford. So be on the lookout for that in a couple weeks. And after that, in keeping with Larry and Bringing Out the Dead, we are going to be unpacking the B-sides of legendary filmmaker Martin Scorsese. So a lot of good stuff coming your way. Again, thank you for listening, and we will be back in 2 weeks. And now you're listening to the B-side.